Welcome to Arizona Quail Today, your go-to podcast for all things quail hunting in Arizona. We're dedicated to educating and inspiring the next generation of quail hunters. A big thanks to our supporters and proud partners, Arizona Outdoor Adventures, Fathers in the Field, and Marsupial Gear. Thanks for tuning in, and now let's dive into today's program.
Hey guys, welcome to Arizona Quail Today. My name is Ryan Rice. I'll serve as the host. This is the first episode, hopefully of many, many more to come. Our producer is Nate Eistreit, a brand new quail hunter and a tech-savvy genius. So we are so excited. Today on the episode, I'm hosting a friend of mine, Matt Russell. He's the owner and operator of Double Arrow Guides, along with First Aid Canine. And so, Matt, thanks for joining us on the show today. How are you doing?
Doing well, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, buddy. So we're talking about kind of a postseason report, and you know, I want to help educate and encourage our listeners. Hopefully, in today's show, what we can do is we can cover subjects of, you know, how did the season go for you and your clients? Tell us a little bit about that. Gears, guns, dogs, some of the bird numbers that you saw. And then also at the end of it, I'd like to open it up for kind of an ask anything. And so as Nate's a new hunter, we want to open up questions and always be working to help educate and encourage the next generation of hunters. So let's start with your business and kind of like, what do you, let's start with hunting. First of all, how'd you get into quail hunting? Let's start there.
Good question. How did I get into quail hunting? It was actually through a friend that I've known since high school. And I started out big game hunting with my father back when I was 12, 13 years old. My dad is 81 right now. He's not so much in the game, but he loves hearing the stories and the reports back that I get to him. He grew up back east and into big game hunting. And because back then, when he was a kid, say in the 50s, if you didn't kill a deer and put something on the table, you had to, you know, kill a cow out of the farm. So definitely much different generation than what we have today. I love putting food on the table, of course. And then of course the sport of it as well. And so he was only into bird hunting really just to, you know, shoot a pheasant in the end of the cornfield because mom said, you know, we need to put dinner on the table. So that was his only bird hunting. But yeah, back in high school, I would say that a friend was getting into some bird hunting. And then later on, he got me into it. And, you know, going out bird hunting without a dog, pretty fun. As soon as you hunt birds with a dog, it's a game changer. You'll never go back. So that was, it was definitely through a really good friend. We're still good friends today. I head up to, I was in Montana for probably 7 seasons, you know, shooting pheasants and sharp-tailed grouse and huns. You know, we had some friends with some, retrievers for some waterfowl. So that was definitely a good time. And then from there, it just spiraled, I'm not going to say out of control, but just spiraled into control. And so, you know, you end up getting a bird dog and then, well, they just seem to multiply somehow. So that's definitely through the friends. And then from there, you just find other friends and then you network with people. And man, it's just such a good time walking fields with old friends and then meeting new friends.
Yeah, man. Well, you know, it's really interesting to me with the quail hunting my guess is most quail hunters, and I don't know about most, but I would bet most diehard quail hunters that love it, they gotta love dogs, you know, because when you get to see the dog at work, it's like a whole new level. And so, even for me in Arizona, I've had a hard time even putting in for big game. Although I love meat, I love big game hunting, but I have a hard time wanting to turn loose of quail season because I love to be out in the field with my dogs, you know.
Yeah, I agree. You can put in the lottery and get drawn for, you know, say deer or elk, whether it be cow or bull or, you know, javelina, turkey, anything like that, any big game species that we have. And we do have a lot of good big game here in Arizona. But even at that, not when, but if you get drawn, you have a 7-day period, you know, unless it's OTC archery or something, you have several weeks or a month or, you know, the whole season. But you have 4 months, almost 4 months that you have here in Arizona. If you're a Monday through Friday kind of guy, then you're gonna be hitting the weekends, and if not, you take a day off, or where else can you just go hunting and either come home with something or not come home with something? But either
I
way,
know.
you're out of the city, you're in the fields, you're enjoying the beauty of the landscape, the species, the habitat, and then of course just following a dog. That's where that's the game changer with upland bird hunting, that relationship that you develop and with a dog is just, it's unmatched, really, I think.
And I mean, coming from Arkansas, for me, where you can buy a license at Walmart or buy it online, and then it's kind of over the counter. You get, deer, turkey, bear, whatever. And I grew up like that and did a lot of duck hunting, and that's where I fell in love, for me, with dogs. And so we're working with duck dogs. But then I moved out to Arizona, and it's like, man, if I wanted to hunt big game, it's like a lottery system, and so I couldn't survive that vision. So I had to be like, I've got time. I'm gonna grab my gun and I'm gonna go right now and go hunt. And that's what quail hunting affords. And for the organic movement, my message is always like, man, this is clean meat. I mean, this doesn't get any better than this. Cook it like chicken. All right. Well, we've chatted a bunch about that. Tell us a little bit about what you do. You're a guide. I've been out with you. You've got an excellent operation. You're expanding. Let's talk about this last year. How did it go for you guys? I think you've added some folks to the team. You guys are working, it sounds like, predominantly in southern Arizona. Tell us kind of like, what did you see? How many miles? Give us any stats and stories that you want to share.
Our season for quail, started in the middle of October, and I always try to get out for some personal days before work really gets started, to actually put some boots on the ground. But at that time of the year in southern Arizona, it's definitely still snake country out there. So, put some be smart about it, and wear some snake gaiters. And just to do some basically scouting with a shotgun. I don't run dogs personally in southern Arizona until the end of November. Even then, it's there's definitely no guarantee. So one certainly should just be aware of their surroundings. I always tell myself, definitely myself and clients and anyone else that may be new to quail hunting, or sometimes an old quail hunter that maybe just gets a little too complacent with walking through the desert. You can't walk through the desert like you own it, because eventually the desert will own you. So certainly be aware of that. Just common sense things. To where if if and when you do or should learn about rattlesnakes, on a hot day, anything like say over 95 degrees, those rattlesnakes that they tend to, reptiles, they'll tend to overheat, so they'll be in the shade. And anything under that, they'll want the sun. So you kind of have to watch those shady spots, those sunny spots. Yeah, really, in October, I mean, Gambles and Scale, I thought they were doing pretty well with their numbers this last season. 15, 20 bird coveys, which is pretty decent for our generation. You talk to some of the some of our elders, if you will, respectfully call them. Those probably were not good numbers back then. Yeah, but for our generation, 15, 20 bird coveys, that's pretty healthy. Everything's been hunting them ever since they were hatched. So, even coming into November, usually I head out of state. I know we're talking about Arizona, but we're all also talking about dogs and their safety and keeping them conditioned, whether it be cardio condition or just, condition on wild birds. So usually I go out of state and, go trucker hunting up north, out of state, or say up to Montana. But back to Arizona, the end of November is when we start running dogs in the field. We start bringing in clients into our fields. And so, clients will come from all around the nation. This past season and the season before, we had four guys come in from Russia. They're Russian. They actually live in California, working for a tech company, but it's definitely really cool to have some people that are not from here, so you can educate them on again the species, the habitat and the landscape and such.
Wow, what were those guys hunting back in Russia? I mean, they didn't just come out here like probably not hunters. They
No, the you know I did ask them, and they spoke really good English, fortunately. But the best that they could describe it was some sort of grouse, partridge, but definitely a species that we do not have here.
Wow, well,
But
that's
what one guy, he brought his own dog, so which is cool, which we certainly do. We do promote our clients bringing their dog in the field, assuming that they actually they'll get along well with our dogs, and there's no fights or anything like that. And then I guess we can move on to into Mearns as far as like through the calendar, getting into Mearns numbers or whatever. We all knew, we always saw the writing on the wall, at least we here who live in Arizona, that just not receiving the summer rains that we should have, by August. And so Mearns numbers were definitely down, which we saw happening. So just one has to be just ethical on their harvest, and not kill too many birds out of a covey, and or passing on a small covey. So that's a big thing that we really have within our operation, is just hunting ethics, and with that just comes education. Yeah, so you can justify those ethics on with your clients.
Yeah. How many miles do you think you guys logged this year? This last season? Or your dogs?
For years I actually used to be a nerd and log it on a spreadsheet on my phone, and log in my dog's miles and mine, and then eventually I just chalked it up to it's about the same every year. So I usually do about an average about 10 miles a day, and with my dogs they'll easily do double if not triple that. However, because we have enough dogs that we can rotate the dogs throughout the day, that say 2 hour hunt or 2 hour shift, if you want to call it, 2 to 3 hours, no more than that, is what my dogs will hunt per day. They'll easily do double the miles that I do all day, simply because they're running. We're just taking a nice stroll through the countryside.
So, big question, how many days did you hunt or guide out of the year? I guess let's just say hunt.
Yeah, sure. It was just shy of 100. I won't embellish it saying that I hunted over 100 days, but I think it was just shy of that, somewhere around there, between hunting in Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico, back to Arizona, and then we wrapped up our season in New Mexico over there. So I'd say just under 100.
That's great. Tell us about your dogs.
The dogs.
Oh, the
So,
dogs.
oh,
Or
the
do we want to go
dogs.
back to the birds for a moment? I don't want to leave off, but and maybe we'll so anything you just kind of touching base on that before we jump into the dogs.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if we want to talk about the birds and habitat and stuff, but scaled quail, I'll start off with scaled quail because I have a lot of mad respect for that species, and I think a lot of people maybe don't, because they possibly just don't understand them, which probably just means that they just haven't hunted them enough. Everyone says, "I don't like hunting them, they just run too much." And I say, "Well, yeah, if somebody was running after me with a shotgun, some dogs, I'd probably run away too." Assuming that scaled quail have the proper cover and the habitat they have, which is primarily, like say 3,500 feet and up, maybe definitely 4,000, 4,500 feet. Basically your typical grasslands where a cactus gets too cold for cactus to really live, which is great. And that's one of the reasons why I love scaled quail, is because you will most likely not pick cactus out of your dog, which nobody really enjoys that. And of course the dog does not enjoy that either. The grasslands, they're just so easy for a dog to run through. There's not a lot of resistance on them, and as far as booting a dog, I don't really boot my dogs too much in that kind of habitat. And will the scaled quail run? Absolutely. But then once you kind of bust them out and you get a wild flush in the distance, they didn't hear you from 50 yards away. They've been running the whole time. Well, it takes one of them to get airborne, and then it's just covey mentality. They're all just going to fly at the same time. And then you watch where they land, and you hustle. You get up over there, and then you can really start having fun with them. So yeah, a lot of mad respect for them. They're gorgeous too. Absolutely gorgeous birds. So go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, what were the numbers that you saw this year for scaled quail kind of versus gambles, merns, like covey sizes?
Yeah, covey sizes, I would say a lot of 15 bird coveys out there, a handful of 20 bird coveys, and we got into a couple small pockets. There were definitely, I'd say, 25 bird coveys. And that's not embellishing it or just, kind of, I see enough covey rises throughout the years that, and sometimes you don't even have to see them. Sometimes you can just hear them off in the distance, and you look off in that distance, go, all right, I didn't see where that covey got up, but that sounded like a lot of wing beats. We should head over there versus, hearing just a single getting up there, or, a handful of birds going, there's a bigger covey. Let's go find them. Gambles, I'd say the gambles were doing pretty good this last year. And I know definitely up in the Phoenix area, from what I heard from a lot of my friends up there, and actually from you, gambles coveys were definitely bigger than in Southeast Arizona or Southern Arizona, even around the Tucson area. From what the reports I got from you and other people, gambles were doing fantastic up there, which is great. I mean, I was hearing about 30 plus bird coveys, numerous. And I don't think I ever got into a 30 bird covey of gambles all season long. They even within the last 2 or 3 years.
I had the I'm going to tell you a quick story. I had the hunt
Sure.
of my life. It was the best hunt I've ever been on, and I had hunted early that morning, and I went out to one spot and worked my butt off in an area I thought there was going to be birds, and I took a guy out who'd never hunted before, and we didn't do very well. And I was kind of discouraged because I knew my days were numbered in the sense of I was closing out the season. So I jumped in the truck and I went from I think it from one national forest to the next, and then drove an hour, and then I just so happened, it's like one of those moments. I'm sitting there and I have that dog. I don't know if you've met Happy yet. He's that
Yep,
new
I
English
did.
pointer. And so I have him and I'm thinking, man, I've worked so hard on this dog, but he needs like under his belt just one really, really good hunt. And sure
Yes.
enough, it's the last day of the season, and I got Zona in the back too, and she's mad at me for doing this. But I'm like, you know what? I pulled up and I parked, and I saw about 50 to 60 gambles quail just kind of scoot along the side of the road. And
Wow.
I know the cover was incredible. And I thought, if I can pressure those birds real hard and get them to just spread out, we're gonna have a heyday. And sure enough, we got them. And I mean, I released the dog and I got out and I just literally charged across this and slid underneath this barbed wire fence and pressured those birds as fast as I could, and they just scattered. And then we had 45 minutes and I bagged 9 birds in 45 minutes.
Wow, that is a fantastic
It
hunt.
was like the hunt. And I did another hunt earlier this season where I had the joy to hit the Grand Slam, and that was fun. But that was so much hard work, and it was so slow, and it was great. And I was working with Zona, and Zona's the veteran dog for me, and it was great. And I it was the, it, I'll never forget it. However, having that opportunity, and you're right, the gambles quail in the more central Arizona area, and I think it's totally likened to rainfall. I could be wrong, but. Man, that there were big, big coveys. But again, the terrain's a lot harder, and so it's harder to get these birds. Because had those birds flushed, even let's say 400 or 500 yards in a different area, I wouldn't have been able to hunt them very well. They would escape. And so most of my hunts that I did, I'd see big numbers of birds, like I was sharing with you earlier in the season. But a lot of the areas that I'm hunting, they're harder to hunt and it's very scattered as far as the terrain. So it's just very spotty. I mean, it's places where you're gonna trip and fall, or you're gonna get stuck by some cholla, or I mean, there's a reason why those birds are operating in high numbers in those areas.
Yes, exactly. They're smart. Little 8 ounce bird, give or take a couple tenths of an ounce. They're pretty smart. I got into, speaking of gambles, years ago, I was on my way up to the White Mountains, and more or less, say around the Globe area, and which correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think a lot of people maybe hunt birds around there. But, hunting gambles in the universe, if one has never hunted gambles in the universe, you should probably throw it on your list, because then you'll add just a little extra respect for that bird, because they do have just way different cover. You're not going to really be seeing running on the ground, and the topography of that kind of area with the junipers, it's basically like hunting gambles in Murren's country. And
It's
you want an added challenge,
surreal.
do that. And then New Mexico has a lot of areas that are as like classic Murren's country, but gambles live there. And it is a good challenge, because you have a bird that's running uphill in Murren's country. And at least myself, I'm a decent shooter. I don't bag a lot of birds on gambles in juniper country. But again, they have great cover, and good for them if they can evade a predator such as myself.
I was talking to, Dan Priest. He's the founder of
I do.
Q5 and really the founder of Arizona Quail Today. And I asked him
Sure.
the other day, I said, "What's the favorite, your favorite bird to hunt?" And I was expecting Murns because everybody loves Murns. And he said, "Gambles." I said, "Really?
Yeah.
Tell me why." And it made sense after I experienced that gambles hunt that I just described. He said, and I'm paraphrasing and going off my memory, but what I recall him saying was, one of the reasons why I love gambles is typically, not always, they can run in bigger coveys. And then when you scatter those birds and they're in thick cover, like good cover, they're going to hold just
Oh yeah.
wonderful. And that's what Happy got to experience. That dog was throwing points and these birds were exploding right under his nose. And I was like,
Yep.
I was just like flabbergasted. I was like, wow. I mean, it's just if you can find those areas where you're operating with those gambles quail in some pretty good cover, then man, it makes for a fun hunt. It's like popcorn walking through a field,
Yeah, absolutely.
you
Yeah,
know?
gambles and scaled, if they have the proper cover, they can, will, and do hold just like Merns. And no one really kind of figures that out until that dog's on
All
point
right.
and they're in some thick cover, and that you had some, scalies out there in the distance, and the dog goes on point, and you're kicking a bush going, "There's nothing there." Third kick. No kidding. They do hold really well, assuming that they're pressured enough, and then they're scattered, and then they're a covey bird, and so once they realize that they don't have the rest of their covey, they're just going to sit back and hold tight, and then hopefully somebody's going to call them in, and then they'll recovey back up.
And I there's a for me there's been a little bit of like I wouldn't say a guilt, but a super high conscientious mindset towards the Murns, because I mean you don't have to be an expert to figure it out, but you look at the map, Arizona Game and Fish, and you see where these birds are located, and geographically speaking, I mean it's a very small area. You look at Gambles quail, they're all over the place.
Very high. It's the most widely spread quail in the entire state.
And so you're like, okay, well, there's more of them than anything. And then you see the scaled quail, and you're like, wow, there's cool pockets of that. But for me, when I'm hunting Murns, it's been, I mean, it's like an epic experience just because I don't really hunt them a lot because I'm all around gambles country. But it's an
Sure.
epic experience. But I'm super conscientious, and I mean, I'm curious. You tell me, have you ever seen these large coveys like what I'm talking about with gambles and Murns? I mean, like what's the largest covey you've ever seen? Because when I'm out hunting, I see coveys of, I mean, the most I saw in a covey this last season for Murns was maybe 10, 8, something like that.
Yeah,
7.
this past season we got into a handful of 10 plus bird coveys. One of the guys working with our operation, he got into a couple 15 bird coveys, but it was in some gnarly country to where what we kind of call, this is not client worthy, with all due respect to our clients, it's just, we're not out there to beat them up, that they're out there to enjoy the experience, versus sending them up Mount Vesuvius, to quote one of my good friends, Scooter. So some of those pockets of Murns this last season where the numbers were down, if you got into some decent bird numbers, you probably were not in some little walk in the park kind of Mearns country. You're up in some sweet little, cuts and canyons that nobody maybe, possibly didn't hunt last year, or that's just where like the convergence of water kind of ran down, and so therefore there was just more, more opportunity for insect hatch and production and stuff.
You know what's crazy too, though, about those Mearns, and I talked about this with somebody recently, another hunting buddy. But you go down to like Hog Canyon, these famous spots where you're just, it's notoriously overcrowded in all these places. Like, I don't know, despite all the pressure, you're still gonna, I mean, and I don't like going down there because it's so crowded, but
I don't.
despite all the pressure, you're still finding birds there, It's like the, I guess it's just must be the most incredible habitat in the state or something. I don't know, but.
It can be. Yeah, it can be, but it does, areas like that do get pressured, and it, especially with the technology of Onyx and everything, one could just find a name of a canyon, and when loose lips sink ships, and so I tend to keep my lips pretty tight, not for the business aspect of it, just to, if you end up finding a nice area, just keep it to yourself, and
What would you,
and also just so the birds just aren't really pressured, that much.
what would you say would be a good ethical approach, especially for new listeners or out-of-state hunters, because I bumped into a situation where I was hunting these Mearns in a very isolated area, and they happened to know where where the birds were, and because somebody had told them, and it's like they just kept coming back and hitting the same few coveys, and over a few days, and they were out of state, and I know their mentality. Their mentality was, I'm getting in the truck and I'm leaving, so I don't have time to go look for a bunch of other coveys. I just want to hit the same ones over and over again. And it's like, man, that's terrible because it's gonna wipe out that covey. And so, when I saw their truck parked back in the same location, I was like, dude, I'm not going back there. There's no way.
No,
Like I,
I mean, it's.
they've already been pounded several times. So what would you say, ethical kind of guidelines, especially for Mearns?
So, going back to me saying, trying to obviously educate, other people, and obviously with guiding clients that. That the Mearns are definitely a very special and sensitive bird. If one does not know about them, they should read up on them. Obviously, it's a natural resource, and that if you have some decent dogs, you're and you can judge your habitat, you're probably going to get into those birds. But it's not all about killing birds. Does everyone like a bird in the bag? Absolutely, I do. Everyone else does. To me, and to a lot of people that have dogs, it's all about the dog work, and it just comes down to you found a covey, shoot on a covey rise, estimate how many birds there were, and don't chase too many singles. Move on and find another covey, because the enjoyment, the experience of that covey rise, that excitement, that explosion of birds, that's what you want. And there are more birds down that canyon, or on the canyon over, or just, think outside the box. It's just because you find some oak trees, you might find some Mearns. Really think outside of the box, and you can find Mearns in some areas that are, you may not even see an oak tree in sight. You're close enough to their habitat, maybe towards some foothills and such. But yeah, my advice would just be ethical about it. And you have to think, like a covey, that's mom, dad, and they're young right there. And so you have a covey of 10 Mearns at the beginning of the season. It was probably a bigger covey than that before we got out there with some dogs and shotguns. Because again, as soon as they started hatching, they're getting picked off by other predators. And
Hawks,
if you
owls,
if you
snakes,
yeah
coyotes,
bobcats, I mean, you name it.
roadrunners,
So you have such a special and sensitive bird like that, to where you get into a covey, that's great, and go find another one, because it does all about the dog work, yes, but it's also about the landscape and the habitat, and just find something new. The exploration part of upland bird hunting, like I said before, is unmatched by with some big game hunting, because you'll be doing some hiking and exploring and glassing some hills, but you're glassing hills looking for that one animal. But upland bird hunting, you're putting boots on the ground. Say you walk a mile or two, you don't turn a covey. Beats any other day sitting at a desk.
You know, one of the things that I've kind of personally done is just kind of set a limit for myself. So, and you know, it's like, I don't know, you reframing how you think about things. And so, you know, when I grew up as a kid and we were duck hunting, we would always talk about limiting out. You know, did you limit out? And it was on a point system back in Arkansas, and then they switched it to, you know, X amount of mallard, you know, drakes versus hens and all this other stuff. And so then we talked about that, and I came out here and I just said, forget all that. I just want to set a limit. Like, I'm three is my limit. So I'm like, hey, I limited out. And I told my son, I was like, you know, usually there's not a day that goes by when I go out hunting, I don't limit out. And he's like, what, Dad, you've been getting into birds? I was like, yeah. He said, what do you mean? I told him, I said, well, I set my limit to three, so I feel good about myself. And my dog got some work, and I'm done. I don't want to spend, for me and my season of life, what I'm doing. You know, I'm out a few hours here and there, a couple times a week if I can, and happy, you know.
There's yeah, again, like you were saying, or I was saying earlier, that it's nice to have a bird in the bag. Yes, of course. At least at the end of my day, whether it's a guided hunt or a personal hunt, who wants to clean 15 birds at the end of the day? That's a lot of work. Like, you already worked enough out there in the field. If I guess if you have this epic day and you get into a dozen coveys of, desert birds, and there are 15, 20 birds here and there, and you start doing the math and the percentage, going, okay, I didn't actually really do that much damage to them.
Like I said earlier, nine birds, 45 minutes. I mean, it was an epic moment. It was a big covey of 50, and then right beside that was another covey of 10 to 15 to 20 birds. I mean, there was just birds everywhere. So I was like, you know what? We're good. We're good.
And you said at the end of the season, so obviously those birds will still be continued to hunt be hunted, and especially as they start breaking up and pairing up or something in the end of the in the springtime. But those late season birds, and everyone talks about late season birds, no matter what kind of upland species you're hunting, they do get smart, they get real savvy, and which is also a great part of bird hunting, realizing, you got some young, dumb birds in October and November, and they'll stick and hold because they don't really quite know what to do. And then they realize, hey, every time we stick and hold, we lost Jerry yesterday, we lost Cindy this morning. Like, I'm gonna start running and get away from this predator. So late season birds are great, but again, we were talking, if you scatter them enough, those late season birds, they'll stick and hold like glue out there.
Well, let's jump into talking a little bit about some dogs, and then I want to save time to talk about some gear. And so, and then to wrap it up, I want to chat about maybe just some frequently asked questions for new listeners. So, where do you want to start? Guns. Well, and in closing off, so would you say it was a great season, a good season, average season? How would you rank the season? And then we'll close off this bird discussion on kind of postseason report.
For me personally, and the other guides that we have within our outfit, I would say that it was a good season.
Mearns being the spottiest, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, me personally, I was in Mearns Country 5 days this last season. One on a personal hunt, the other four with clients. Simply because, even as transparent and with my clients as we were, they're the bucket list birds, and I got it. But yeah, just being very honest and upfront with people, saying we can go Mearns hunting, but we're not going to be beating up these coveys. Even opening weekend for Mearns on my personal hunt. I remember it. My dog pointed two pairs. That's horrible. And a covey of four, five, seven, and eight, and that's it. And that was on a personal hunt. And so that was kind of seeing that writing on the wall that was really predicted. So yeah, we definitely hunted Merns the least this last season because I'm out there for the dog work and wing shooting, and everyone does want to see a larger covey in the air for many reasons. And so I would say our season, it was a good season. I don't tend to use like maybe what like some game and fish departments say, you know, below average, average, above average. That's pretty vague. You know, like you have three choices and that's it. So overall, a vague kind of summary, I would say for desert birds, it was I would say it was a good year, and Merns definitely was for us personally, it was a poor year.
I think that was, I mean, that's consistent with what I've heard all across the state. Definitely there were pockets where the gambles hunting was just pretty amazing, you know, but yeah, that's kind of what I've been hearing, and we've been getting a lot of good winter rains here recently, so it looks like,
Great winter rains. This current El Nino pattern that we're in right now, cold and wet winters is what we're going to have. That is where the desert birds, gambles and scaled, will thrive. Unfortunately, with that pattern, with the El Nino that we're in right now, we're looking at a hot and dry summer, and possibly hotter and drier than last summer, which last summer's monsoons were definitely poor. So
Makes it
my
bad.
prediction, I mean, gambles and scaled, I think they're going to be really good this upcoming year. Merns, go ahead and save that bucket list bird for another season, and we just need to be just really aware of that. You know, just that's all it is, just awareness for the bird. You know, just don't kick them while they're down.
So, I mean, just as a summary for you listeners, some of the things that we've been talking about is that it was a good season overall, but the Merns, they're the birds that were the spottiest, and we haven't been receiving in Arizona good monsoon rains, and those really help those birds thrive, and we're looking at that, we're looking at not having another good monsoon. Time will tell, but our winter rains have been really, really good. And for some consecutive years, and that really does add up. In a future podcast, I'm going to have a couple biologists on the program to be able to share a little bit more about that and also what they're doing right now in this spring season. And so we're looking forward to that. But Matt, thanks for sharing about the postseason report. Let's get into guns and dogs and maybe answer some, and a little bit more about some gear. So where do you want to
Sure
start?
thing. We'll start with dogs, and that one of my dogs just hopped out of her kennel. That's a good sign right there. I personally run the Brocq du Bourbonnais pointers. They're the French pointer. They're from the region of Bourbonnais, France. And the easiest way to remember the breed is to think about taking a sip of bourbon, but throw the phonetic A at the end, Bourbonnais. Brock
Bourbonnais.
means Bourbonnais, yes. Brock meaning like pointer, and then of the region of Bourbonnais, France. Tapped into that breed maybe 12 years ago or so, and people get, I've obviously I'm guilty, and other people are as well. You find a breed, and if it works for you, stick with it. They're a great disposition at home, and then out in the field, I believe that they do have a switch. You know, they you can turn them on and off, so they're not just some spastic dog that you're wondering, what am I going to do with this thing for the other 8 months of the year that I can't. You can't replicate the miles that you put on out in the field. You can't replicate that during the off season. So really like the breed. They do have cut dock tails, and some people, like to have like a full length tail, like say your dogs, and for the indication of your dog on point. But if you see a dog, 100 yards off in the distance, and if you can't tell if a dog's on point, whether they have a tail or not, you should probably go, probably go home anyways. But great dogs, and some of my dogs are close rangers, say 50 yards, and I have one of my girls. She had 2 points, numerous or whatever, but that stick out. There's a 370-yard point out from us, and she held the whole time until we got up there, and then another at 430 yards on point. And these are all on desert birds. I think both those, one was a gambles, and the other one was a scaled. But so a wide range of ranging dogs in between. And you can certainly just, every dog has their strength and weakness. And if you have a close ranging dog, maybe that's just your Mearns dog, if you can't get them to open up. And then if you have a long ranging dogs, just, use that potential and get them out in the desert bird country because it's just so vast. There's not a lot of obstructions. It's just wide open land. So let them cast 200 yards off to the left hand side. If there's no birds over there, you didn't waste your miles. You didn't waste your time going over there because the dog pretty much told you there's no birds over there.
And how many of those dogs do you have?
Currently, we own six. So, we hunt more than that. I think we hunt 10 dogs. So basically, between clients' dogs that can't get out in the field as often as we do, because everyone wants to, again, it's all about the dog work. And so if one is not able to get out in the field as often as somebody else could, we'll take other clients' dogs and get them on wild birds or other friends' dogs that have latched on to the same breed as myself. So I tend to borrow some dogs. It's all about dog power, and it's all about the dog's learning and exposure, and that's all it is. It's just a dog just needs to be exposed, over and over, no matter what age. But of course, at a young age, that dog just need I refer to it as like a dimmer switch, where like the electricity is always there, like a dimmer switch on a light bulb. Electricity is always there, but if you can slowly turn that dimmer switch up and up and up until you have all that fullest potential of that power, you just need to tap into that, and just the exposure of that dog getting into a covey, and then you chase after some singles, and then it really starts to click with these dogs. So, six is for me is a good number, but I always tell myself and other people, say you go into a season with four dogs, not fatally, but you kind of almost have to let yourself know you may close out the season with three dogs because there's just so many hazards out there. And so many variables, and everything's just so unpredictable. Every day is different. To me, back to your question, like how good was my season? Yeah, the bird numbers were pretty good. But if I leave the season with the same number of dogs that I enter with, I consider that a good season, Ryan.
Man, and I mean, you logged what, 2,000 miles with your dogs, something like that.
Sheesh. Again, I stopped being a number nerd about that on the spreadsheets and stuff. But,
Yeah, but you remember perhaps what you did in years past.
yeah, I'd say,
That's
usually
like
I'll put
running
about,
across the country.
I'll usually do about 800 plus miles on my feet. And so with running my dogs on their own
Six,
shift throughout the
1,600
day,
miles, yeah.
yeah, let's say 1,600 or something like that. Easy
Wow.
number there. But will my dogs and say yours or anyone else's dogs, will they run all day? Yes. And if you only have one or two dogs and you can only get out so many days a week, you're probably going to run that dog all day. But then that dog may just be couch potato or kennel dog for the next couple of days to recoup. But in order to, at least in my opinion, in order to have that dog last the entire season, you can't run them all day, every day, because they're, you can joke about them being a machine or a tool, but eventually that tool is going to break. And just like you and I will get fatigued if we push ourselves to the limit, we can tell ourselves to stop. And, but the dog just doesn't have that concept. It's all about go. So, that's my method of keeping the dogs in good enough health, and basically telling them, no, like, you had your 2 hour shift. You did or did not get into some birds, and tomorrow might be another day, and that's
I mean,
it. And
but
rotate out.
you got like a small basketball team though. I mean, like most quail hunters, they're lucky if they got one dog, and then you're something if you got two. But Matt, you got six. But I mean, hey, if I was a commercial guide, if I was doing what you, I'd have six dogs. I've seen your
You have
setup.
to, Ryan. You have to, man.
I mean, you're running every day. I mean, like you're full throttle, man. I mean, that's awesome.
If I'm not working a day, I'm working my dogs. And that we had a litter of pups this last June, with one of our girls, and we kept a pup, of course, because you can't not keep a pup out of the litter. And it was all about that little dog. And those of you that that say, I guess I'll throw out the social media thing. If you're following me on Gun Dog Run on Instagram, you've probably seen or heard about Western, and she has definitely come a long way. She's definitely the latest pup that we've had through in the end of the season or end of the year. So entering our season, she was 4 months old, and so I threw her to the wolves and went, I only have so much time to be working with some Penry's birds, so it's all about wild bird exposure. And I've definitely seen her accelerate on just wild bird hunting for such a young pup. She's 8 months old now, hunting three different states, five different species of birds, and it is starting to click with her. She's done an exceptional job. I'm really proud of her, and there's definitely obviously many more seasons to come with that girl.
Yeah, and I you know, this is a first year for me. I got to train. Well, I mean, Happy's about a year and a half old now, and having Happy train near or under Zona, my veteran dog, but I think it accelerated the program. You
Oh, absolutely.
know what I mean? Like, he's
They
back
learn from each
in his
other.
first year. He just started retrieving. Like, I'm like, gosh, it took. Granted, I was not as knowledgeable as I am now, and I still have a long ways to go as a dog trainer with pointing dogs. But you know, boy, he accelerated. I can only imagine Western's picking up so much from Arrow and all the rest of your dogs. You know, they're just learning. They're just watching and learning, you know.
She was at also about 4.5 months old. He honored another dog's point for the first time at 4.5 months old.
Yeah, that's
We
amazing.
had no training, and it just happened. Dog went no one I'm not sure. One of my dogs went on point, and it was like 15, 20 yards back. She just stopped and just stared at the back end of that dog.
And you're like going,
And
woo!
what I can't I think I was out by myself, and it was with that moment to where you look around going, does anyone am I the only one seeing this? No, really, like nobody's gonna believe me. But it's really cool when you see a dog instinctually work, and then from there going, all right, we may have some hiccups and speed bumps, and I know we will, but man, I think you got a lot of potential here, girl.
One of the things I love about quail hunting and the is the community of quail hunters, typically, not all, but there's a lot of they're just dog people. They're not, I mean, I'm not gonna say they're not cat people, but I'm definitely not a cat person. But they're definitely dog people. Like I love to say I'm a dog man. Like, man, that's what I am. I love dogs. I'll find if I see a German Shepherd, and I was just down in Mexico this last week or whatever. This girl's working on a German Shepherd that's got too much energy, which means the dog's not working enough. And I just said to her, I just like pull, you know, I said, hey, you know, I love dogs. Or do you love dogs, obviously. Do you need help training this dog? And she's like, oh man, I do. And just, I mean, the passion for dogs, and that's the fun part, I think, for quail hunters. A lot of quail hunters, they'll be around like-minded people that for quail hunting to be at its max, it feels like you just, that dog creates this experience that's very few things in life are that cool is seeing that dog on point, the birds flush, the shot, the drop, hopefully the retrieve if you can get it. You know, it's too much fun. And you're that dog man. Boy, I remember rolling out to your camp and I'm like, little Mayo's with me and I think he's got a lot of dogs. And she's like, oh, I can't wait. I want to meet them all. I was like, all right, well, make sure they're nice, you know, we'll see. But you've got a reputation. Your dogs are excellent. I've talked to a number of guys and they're like, Matt's got some really good dogs.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. I always tell people that my dogs are not perfect. They can, will, and do make mistakes, but they certainly will give it their best. And just like we humans, so we can learn from our mistakes as well. And so it's just it's back to that word exposure. Just get your dog out there and get them exposed. Pen-raised birds. Sure, if that's your thing, and pigeons or some bobwhites or something, get a hold of some pen-raised chuckers. But wild birds is where it's at. That's where dogs really start to learn that if I don't find this bird, it could possibly run off on me, and dog creeps in on a point. Well, let that dog think. If the dog's constantly just busting coveys, okay, then yeah, you need to correct that mistake. But if that dog's creeping, especially on gambles and scaled, and those birds well enough, there's a really good chance that that covey, that scent is literally getting, it's fading away. And so that dog wants that intensity of that scent. Like it's getting weaker and weaker. Oh, now it's getting stronger. It's getting weaker. So they're going to creep into it, you know? So me personally, I don't mind my dogs creeping in on a point because I know them well enough that yes, the birds are probably running out there. If you don't get up on that dog, you're going to miss your opportunity. Or if that dog's on point and then you're stomping around going, where is this covey? And all the while those scalies are running from you like, oh, well, it just must have been just, fresh scent.
Well,
No.
and that's the difference between a gun dog man and a trial dog man. You know, like the trial dog man's gonna get so frustrated if that dog takes an inch step. And a gun dog guy's like, well, those birds, I'm watching the wild birds run. Of course my dog's moving, you know, like
Yeah,
that,
sure.
and that's some of the tension, you know. And I think that for guys getting into the sport is they gotta kind of figure out which route you want to run if you're gonna work with your dog. Do you want a trial dog or you want a gun dog? Because there's a lot more rules on the trial dogs, and that's
Yes.
fine. That's fine.
Absolutely.
Just not
Absolutely.
my cup of tea. I like gun dogs, but you know, hey, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're to each their own, and they can do that year round, and we can't. So that's nobody's better than the other.
Well, let's talk about gear a little bit. So you've been running the Marsupial Upland Game Vest for the last couple of years. Tell us about it. How many miles did you log on it? You've had a number of vests. I think you've worn the Q5. You've
I have.
worn the Chief Upland,
I have.
and then now you've switched over for the last couple of years to the Marsupial. Tell us about what you like about it, you know, how it performed, and anything that you think would be helpful to listeners.
Sure thing. Thanks to you for the introduction to Marsupial Gear. And since then, we've certainly developed a great relationship with the company and the owner, Jim Graham. Great company to work with and just great quality as far as stitching and just, it's a bird vest only works for the person that is maybe receptive to how it is built. And some people would prefer another manufacturer. And again, that's on them. And if one doesn't work, find something that does. The Marsupial Gear vest definitely works for me. And I run their Upland vest, which is kind of like their top tier model, simply because I have to carry so much gear anywhere from first aid kit. It fits a 100 ounce bladder. I run the Osprey bladder. I know Camelback decades ago, they're kind of pioneers in that kind of thing. But I prefer Osprey for many reasons. So if it's a 100 ounce bladder there in the back, and what I like about the Osprey is that it's actually structured. So even on a half, I'll say half full, I'll be optimistic, a half full bladder or an empty bladder, the structure still holds. And so you don't have just a big old flop of, 40 ounces sitting at the bottom there. So they're definitely the hydration capable is really nice on that Upland vest. Two water bottle holders that are structured kind of they run padding on the inside of them on the just so the bottle holders don't collapse on you, which is really nice. So there's 232, so I got a 164 ounces is what I carry. If I know that it's a exceptionally warm day, say 60 65 degrees, which is not optimal, but sometimes you especially on a guided hunt, you got to run dogs. I'll carry another water bottle just in the cargo area, like where you put dead birds. Their shell bags, I really like their shell bags. I prefer the small shell bags. They do offer the larger one, but honestly, if you need to carry more than a box of shells, you should probably hit the range or something, or wow, that's just an epic day. But either way, a box of shells is well, you're just carrying around a bunch of lead weight. So I prefer their shell, the small shell bags. Their electronics pouch I have kind of up front on my left-hand side. I run the Garmin 200i controller with GPS. With the I think they're the new the TT25 receivers, the collars for my dogs. I think I have six or seven of those, just because it's inevitable. No matter how much you spend on some gear, you may have a failure. So if you can afford it, definitely I would recommend just so if you have two dogs, make sure you have three collars, one dog, two collars, anything like that. I personally prefer the padded yoke that marsupial makes. And I know, talking with the owner Jim, he's had a lot of complaints about that yoke being padded and being too thick, and that people are unable to shoulder their shotgun. It's messing up their shots. I don't have any problem with that. If I miss a bird, I'm not going to blame it on the padded yoke personally. I'll chalk it up to that bird beat me, you know. But he did release a non-padded yoke, more like a webbing style, like say what WingWorks would be on their bird vests. And I actually did try it out at the end of the season. Went over to New Mexico to close out their season. I told Jim, I said, if you want me to test it out, I will. And honestly, Ryan, I wore it for one day. I switched out that yoke and put it on the rest of my system. Halfway through the day, I wanted to take that bird vest off. I'm not a big guy. My collarbone, you know, sticks out. I don't have a lot of padding on my body, so therefore, I want my bird vest to have some padding. I wore that non-padded yoke for one day, and I took it off. And but
Basically,
go ahead.
the chubby fellas can wear it and they'll be
I
okay.
would say
The
so,
skinny fellas need more of the padding.
I would say the padded yoke definitely works for me. Yes. And you know, it's of course, you know, all these bird vests these days, even some of like the bigger, not necessarily better, you know, companies that are making their vests, everyone's just gone to the MOLLE system simply because it just makes things just so
So much.
well, any modular vest, you know, which the marsupial gear is definitely modular. You can add stuff and subtract it, put it wherever you want. But with the MOLLE system, you can attach just so many attachments on there, and you can maximize the amount of gear that you can bring. And I don't mind weighing down my pack, especially with water. So, you know, say
What,
20, 25 pack.
what's the name of the vest that you got? Because there's like a lot of they're like I know it's a marsupial, but you got the bigger
Yeah,
one.
so the one that I run is the Upland, their Upland bird vest, and then they have the featherweight as well. So I think I may actually pick up the featherweight from them for this upcoming season. You know, just for some personal hunts, but for a guided hunt, I just have to carry so much gear. I'm not carrying a shotgun because the clients are, so I don't mind packing on a little extra weight just for more gear, because I'd rather have it out there and not need it than everyone else knows the rest of that phrase.
I like that featherweight, and then they've got a new pouch system on that featherweight, which is really, really cool.
Yes.
And they've basically inserted those plastic things to kind of open it up a little bit more, which is really cool. And
Yeah.
so it's a lot more accessible from, grabbing a bird or dropping a bird in the bag. And now even with the featherweight, I think that you can, like, it's big enough, I believe, where you can open it up and I could drop a pheasant back there or a chucker, which
Sure.
that would never
Sure.
happen with their some of their older models. But one of the things I love, marsupial has been a supporter and a partner with us with Arizona Quail Today, and specifically with some of the things that we do with the kids. We work with fatherless boys and provide them with mentors and whatnot, and they've been a big supporter of us and a huge help. And then they've worked with like you introduced, I think, this first aid canine first aid kit. I don't even know all the details of what all happened, but tell the listeners what you do with first aid canine and how it's kind of you and marsupial are doing some cool stuff together.
Sure thing. Again, much appreciation to you for the introduction to Jim over there at Marsupial. And so,
I just want 1% of the sales, that's all.
oh, 1%. Okay, all right. Sounds great. Checks in the mail. So yeah, with the introduction to Jim there, speaking with him, he said, yeah, we've been thinking about doing a med kit because that's all he does is make pouches. And he goes, I'm not really sure what to use. I said, well, I've been using this bag, which I was just buying from another supplier, definitely an overseas bag. And I said, can you clone this bag, but take out some redundancies and then make this improvement? And his first thing was, well, this zipper is garbage. I said, yeah, they're not really that great. He goes, he prides himself in the zippers that he puts on his gear, and rightfully so, because never once have I cursed at any of his gear, saying, you know, this zipper is killing me. Nope. So he and I went back and forth, and he said, I'll get you a proto I'll mail you a prototype, in about a month or so, and I think two and a half weeks later, that prototype was on my front doorstep, and it was perfect. And so we just had to go through some other logistics on, putting the tags on there, co-branding it with a marsupial logo and the First Aid Canine logo. And so it was kind of, it was a great partnership that we had, to where there's a, all you have to do is search on YouTube for marsupial gears there, subscribe on their YouTube channel, and Jim and I have a video on the whole breakdown of the contents. And you can buy the bag empty from them, or you can buy it filled through them, or you can go to our website, which is quailarizona.com. And either way, it's the same kit. And in the video, we definitely explained that I didn't reinvent the wheel. I believe that I just made this First Aid Canine kit just very user friendly. And when you open it up, you have these clear vinyl view pouches, to where there isn't any guesswork of like, I'm pulling it out of this pocket and this pocket in time of need, that emergency that I hope nobody really has to encounter, but sometimes it's inevitable. That's, there are a lot of hazards out there. You don't want to be fumbling through a bunch of supplies and wondering where's this, where's that. You can open it up and go, bam, there's those hemostats. Here's that cold pack. Here's that skin stapler, which we hope that nobody has to use. So stuff like that. So it's
And
been a
let
great
me jump
partnership.
in on that skin stapler,
Sure.
like, because I was in Arkansas, did a hog hunt. I'm hunting with pit bulls and Catahoulas. Crazy hunt. I mean, the definition
Sure.
of a redneck hunt. That's what we were on. And then literally the goal was to get these dogs down, and then we were gonna jump on top of the hogs and stab them. And that was,
Yes.
yes. And honestly, it was actually safer to do that than to take like an AR or something like that. But because, I
I would
mean,
say
can you imagine taking an AR with all the dogs and the bloods and the hogs and
no
all
way.
that? I mean, it's
No,
just
yep.
crazy.
Yeah.
So my point is, and jumping in on this story, is a stapler. Like, what's the threat to a dog in Arizona? Why would you need a stapler? Obviously, you got barbed wire fences, but what else are you looking out for?
Yeah, barbed wire fences obviously is, I'd say, on top of the list. If you were to go out of state, like any farm country, pheasant hunting or something, like there's just so much discarded equipment from the old homestead days that you have no idea what's in some of those large grass clumps. But yeah, barbed wire definitely on top of the list. Mesquite out in the out desert bird country. Mesquite is a very hard wood, and unless it's really rotten, mesquite wins and your dog loses. Murren's country oak, another good hardwood. Again, oak wins, dog loses. So I would say that fence posts and stuff. Every now and then you can find some short fence posts, but I'd say barbed wire is probably your biggest threat as far as how your dog would be lacerated, out there and getting a gash. That would probably be on top of the list out there, which,
What about javelina?
yeah, there's that one too. That one, javelin, are definitely a huge threat. That
Is that
is,
something you've encountered out there?
yeah, there's that. That is the sole reason why I carry a sidearm. Personal hunt, guided hunt, anything like that. A javelina can will can and will gut your dog in seconds. Definitely an animal to respect. It is a game animal, so I would suggest not shooting one unless you're really your life or your dog's life is threatened. But
Maybe a little
just re
bird shot to get him away.
Yeah, and make some
We can
noises and
blame that one
such.
on me. We can blame that one on
Sure,
me.
sure. But
Oh,
the
jeez.
javelina, there's such a resilient creature, such a hardy animal that, we've all been out quail hunting in January where it's, say 20, 25 degrees in the morning, and you come across some javelina going, you have little ones with you.
Oh, gosh,
They
yeah.
reproduce year round. They're a
Oh,
very
yeah.
hardy creature, but definitely to be respected. So, yeah, I've definitely encountered them. I've definitely drawn a sidearm at them. Fortunately, I've never had to pull the trigger, which is fantastic. But here's a good quote from one of my hunts maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Two, I think there was a family, maybe four javelina up on top of a hill. We're talking in the distance. And we saw them up on the horizon. I said, "Hey guys, I was with clients. We have some javelina up on top of the hill. Let's just go ahead and walk this direction, not towards there." And then, no kidding, like in the movies, these two big javelina, they start coming down, charging downhill. Mom stays up on top with the little ones. We
What?
could see the silhouettes. And my client goes, "Hey, that looks like they're running towards us." I said, "They are. We need to turn. We need to turn around." And we look back. I said, "They're coming at us, guys, run." I said, "When you see your guide run, you need to run." And the whole phrase, like, you just need to run faster than the slowest guy, right?
Wow.
And the quote of that hunt was, "Run, Randy, run faster," because he was not running fast. And I'm thinking, like, Randy's gonna go down. I'm gonna have to shoot a javelina because Randy is gonna get attacked. It
Oh
was
my
hilarious,
goodness.
man. Guys from, I'll just say back east. I think they were from New York or New Jersey or something. Probably quite a story. I'm still telling that this day. I know they are too. So,
New York City.
simply, yeah, definitely an animal to respect. Yeah, no, no
Well,
joke with those animals.
your first aid kit has it all. I love seeing that stapler in there. When I was out on that hog hunt back in Arkansas, this redneck buddy of mine, he throws his dog up on the four wheeler after the first hog that we took, and he said, "Dadgummit, this dog got tore up." And he literally, I mean, it was a pit bull. And when those pit bulls are, I mean, the adrenaline's pumping through those dogs, you know what
Oh
they're
yeah.
for, man. You're like,
Yeah.
wow, I had never seen this before. And he just cleaned up that thing, poured a bunch of hydrogen peroxide or whatever he poured on that dog, and then he cleaned it up, and then he just started stapling that dog right in front of me on that four wheeler. And I had never seen that before, but then I see the stapler in your kit, and I'm like, okay, I guess so that's what that's for. It's for
Yeah.
long lacerations from barbed wire or javelinas tearing up a dog or whatnot, but
Yeah,
it
yeah.
happens.
The stapler comes with 35 sterile staples in there, and certainly get to your vet if you have to use a stapler on a dog. Your next destination is getting to a vet right there.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the things I haven't done, and I'm curious, like one of the things I think would be a good safety strategy is just have an idea of where the local the veterinarian clinics are.
Absolutely.
You know,
Yep.
when you're
Yep.
out in some areas, especially if you're just kind of a reoccurring hunter in some general areas, and it's just kind of a smart idea to kind of like do a little research and go, if this
Very
were to
smart.
happen, here's where I'd go, because
Exactly.
in the
Yeah.
moment, you're just, it's adrenaline,
Yep. And
so.
everyone has the power of the internet on their phone, but as you're driving, you certainly don't need to be fumbling and then, asking Siri or Google or something on where the next vet, nearest vet is. And my phone, through my contacts, all I have to do is put VET, and I have in capital letters, and I have vets from all the western states, as far east, I guess, far east of, say, Oklahoma. And then I have the town, or say, like, the state there as well. So it doesn't just come up under vet, but the whole list of vets comes up. Very smart. Before you go on any hunt, yeah, find it. There you have time at home as you're already planning the hunt. That is a part of planning your hunt, is finding that vet in that area that you hope to never have to visit. But when you do, boom, right there, it's on your phone. You're calling them up, and you're not fumbling because you have a lot of other things to worry about than to find a vet.
Well, we've talked about some gear, marsupial. Definitely, I would say you listeners, check out marsupial. That's the vest that we wear at Arizona Quail Today. And I'm
Yep.
so grateful for them.
Yeah, made right here in Arizona. Jim definitely prides himself on. He'll correct me on this. I'll just say, 90-some% of his textiles are sourced in the U.S. And then, of course, it's made here in the U.S. right here in Arizona. I know you've been to his facility, so have I. It's very, very impressive. He runs a really tight ship. He's got a really sweet game room, with a bunch of cool mounts and stuff inside there. Very well staffed. For a guy who's only been in business for maybe 8 some years, very proud of the guy. It's really nice to see a small business really accelerate. So I'm proud of that guy, and I'm proud to be a part of, helping him out, and you and me just kind of being those ambassadors, for that to promote a really good product.
Yeah, it is really cool. I mean, you know, like you can stop by their office and just immediately walk into the showroom and then just
Yeah.
immediately look out and see
Try
the
something on.
equipment being made right there.
Yeah, right there. He's got a window sitting there. You can watch everyone on the sewing machines there. Yeah, and you can try something on there while you're there too, and make sure that you like it. Walk around in it. Yep.
Well, and your first aid canine kit, I bought one and I love it. And
Thank you.
Lord willing, I'll never have to use it. But I'm like, it
Me
is
too.
so good. So one of the things we didn't mention is that canine kit, it fits perfectly in the upland vest for
It does.
marsupial, which I
It
put it
does.
in the pocket. I don't like it hanging on the side. I tried
Yep.
that.
I know. Me
I
too. Me
totally
too.
slid it into that pocket, and it feels a little redundant with the quality thing that you got. But I would rather it be self-contained and so
Yes.
wonderfully put together than having to fumble around for stuff and pull stuff out. So I love it. I'm so proud of the setup that you've got
Thank you.
and that vest, and then the lightweight vest that they have. I don't think it fits in there,
It
but
does not fit on there, but Jim and I are, now that we're in the quote unquote, well, I guess quoted off season of bird hunting, even though one may actually need a first aid kit, on other excursions. I need to add everything in there, even though the name is First Aid Canine. Everything is human grade in there, so everything that you can use on your dog, you can also use on yourself. Other than the thermometer, once you stick it in a dog's butt, don't stick it in your mouth. But other than
No.
that, e
Dang it, I
everything
used it on
is
my
I
kids the
know.
other day.
Come on, man, don't do that. On mine, I literally I know better, but on the casing, I wrote dog butt on the outside of the
Nice.
thermometer case. But other
Nice.
than that, everything else is human grade. You can use it on yourself or your dog. But now that we're on the off season for bird hunting, Jim and I are working on a smaller kit that one may not want to carry. It is a 2-pound kit, including the bag itself. To me personally, I'd much rather carry around 2 pounds of something that you hope to never use, but you still do have it. We're all carrying, I'm going to say, a 5 to sometimes an 8 pound shotgun, hopefully not, but we'll say maybe 6, 7 pound shotgun, and all the water that we have to carry here in the Southwest and other gear, sidearm, all that. When it comes down to it, what's another 2 pounds on something that could save you or your dog's life? So, but we are working on a smaller kit. We're actually just going to modify one of his other pouches that he already has, and then just make it, instead of a pouch that zips open, it'll be more of like a fully open clamshell style, just like the First Aid Canine kit has. So a little bit smaller for somebody that maybe don't want to carry that much gear, but at least just the bare minimum essentials, and then you can keep the rest of like the full kit back at the truck as well. So we're working on that in the off season.
And that would fit in the lightweight vest that they've got.
That, yeah, and
Okay.
definitely, I mean, definitely more Molly capable, even though the First Aid Canine kit does have that.
Yeah.
This one's definitely more Molly capable, to where you can attach it on the side.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's I weighed it out. The prototype is, I think, is 1 or 1.1 pounds, so half the weight.
Yeah.
Obviously, less material of the bag, and then a couple less items as well. But either way,
It's good.
yeah, we feel confident that everything's in there that can certainly alleviate a situation, but certainly go to a vet after you administer any first aid to your dog.
Yeah, a couple other things I want to highlight just on the vest, because I am so pumped about this vest. I just love it.
Sure.
They've got that a new cell phone pouch, and I know cell phones are like they're like the Onyx must have now, like so the but
Yeah,
that
it's.
but that cell phone pouch, the it's like a flip magnetic thing. Then I have a pistol, like a pistol little holder, and it's perfect for that. And then a couple other things that I use on there that are just really, really great. It's just
Yeah,
a great setup.
I have a sidearm holster as well, that mounts on it, and never once have I walked or ran through a field in the last 2 seasons running his vest. Never once have I said, "Man, this gun's all over the place." It's stuck
Right.
to you,
Oh,
it,
no, it's good.
and the button snap. Not once have I caught it
No,
on him
yep.
ski branch or looked
Yep.
down going, "Oh, how'd that come unsnapped?" Nope, it's pretty awesome. I'm heading down to Argentina here in about 3 weeks, to host some clients down there to go quail hunting, and talking with Marsupial Gear, he's going to set me up with a couple bird vests to bring down there for the
Gee
outfitter,
whiz.
just to bring marsupial out of the US, you know,
Yeah.
US made and everything, but bring it down there
Yep.
and kind of share that quality and experience with them as well.
Yeah.
And I was a nerd, and I brought my vest down to Argentina last year to go quail hunting,
Oh
simply
yeah.
because it feels so comfortable in my body. It's literally a part of my body, kind of like a shotgun should be an extension of your body
Yep.
if you're that comfortable with it. And
Oh yeah.
so I could have used the Outfitters bird vest down there, but I stripped mine down
No
kind of
way.
bare minimum, and I packed it in my suitcase, and I brought it down there.
That's great. Well, and marsupials all over the world. I mean, he's got
Oh
a
yeah.
global distribution, but the upland side is he that's pretty new to the market in just the
It
last
is.
few years from what I
It is,
understand. So,
and that's why I'm trying to promote him down there,
yeah.
and
That's
expand a little
cool.
bit of, yeah, totally cool.
All right, so we need to wrap up on our session and then try to invite some questions. I've got Nate here in the Arizona Quail Today studio. And Nate, thanks for joining us, buddy. And Nate, you are a new quail hunter. We bagged your first bird together, didn't we? And we got you a bird dog. So why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about yourself, and then let's do some questions. You just do kind of like, hey, this is your first season. You've heard the podcast. Here's some questions that you have.
Yeah, as Ryan said, my name's Nate. New to hunting overall and quail hunting as well. Started out doing over-the-counter archery for deer here in Arizona, and absolutely fell in love with hunting, just being outdoors, all the ethical part about it, and just once I got to know Ryan, I got into quail hunting, and so started doing that. And I did one quail hunt and decided to get all in, so I got a bird dog right away, which is pretty funny. And so, yeah, I love everything about it. It's a lot of fun, and so I wrote down some questions here just to ask for, you know, what somebody who's getting into quail hunting, you know, how they get more experience. And so the first question I wrote is, for new hunters, what should you be looking for when finding a potential location to hunt? You know, maybe the ideal landscape. I know it might be different for each species of quail, but maybe just kind of starting with Gambel's quail, because I live in Phoenix area, and so that's kind of that more desert area. It's not going to be high desert. It's just going to be regular desert landscape. So what's kind of the landscape, maybe terrain you're looking for when looking for a spot or location for Gambel's quail?
You want to jump in and answer that, Matt?
I certainly will, because I have hunted Gambels around the Phoenix area with several friends. Much lower elevation, of course, and you can find gambles in scaled quail country, like in the grasslands. However, where you're at there, Nate, I would say what to look for as you're just driving, and this isn't even during the hunting season. This is, you know, like on your next road trip,
Yep.
as you're getting out of the city and you're on your way up to the mountains or somewhere else. That's just you just doing your homework, so you can pass the test in the future. So I would say up there, more cactus country. And so, you know, you're looking for some prickly pear. I despise Cholla, but Gambels love Cholla because that's just protection for them. I would say look for cactus, and just judge the topography of the land to where can you find gambles on some flat lands? Absolutely. You know, you certainly can, but you know, they're you know, a wild bird like that, they're gonna want to seek shelter if and when a storm comes around or some high winds. And so look for the topography of the land, look for little cuts and drainages throughout the hills, which obviously provides cover from the weather, but then also can retain more moisture and then say on the tops of the hills to where the sun is going to be beating down on it, and that moisture is evaporated. So therefore maybe the grass cover may be a little bit lower there, but a little bit thicker on the bottoms. I would say that's what I would look for there. And then also, as you're say driving, during the off season, if you see a dirt tank like a cattle pond or something, put that inside your head and go, hey, That's a lot of water right there.
Yeah.
I may want to focus around that because, they're desert survivors. Water is the basis of life. So they're going to have to want to hit that water. And they typically will not stray too far from it. So, it's a small little bird. They can only drink so much water, and so they're going to have to come back and hit it. So, yeah, water, basically food, shelter, and water. Their food on a good year should be everywhere. The cover, can come and go here and there, but that water source is pretty crucial. I would probably start with there. What about you, Ryan?
Yeah, I think that's great. I think one of the most simple things you can do, would be if you pay attention to the elevation, it's really important because, yeah, you can find gambel's quail in higher country, like, five, I don't know, maybe 45 feet and 4,500 feet and higher or something like that, but it's not as common. And so, and I, you could pull up the stats on it or whatever. I can't remember, but let's just say 3,500, 4,000. 3,500 feet in elevation is higher than where we're at here in Phoenix. I don't remember
Definitely.
even what the elevation is here. It's like maybe 1,000 or less.
Yeah, 1,000, 1,500, and then speaking earlier, you can get into gambles up in the junipers, which is definitely 5,000, 5,500 some feet. But the gambles being so resilient, they could be from 1,000 feet to 5,000 feet. That's why a lot of respect for that
So
bird.
watch, but don't go chase gambels in the 6,000, 7,000. There's no need to do that kind of thing. Stay lower. And what I would suggest is, it's very simple. Like if you can just download a map, the Onyx map, and get that app. That's a great app. Or you've got just even on Google if you wanted to get on Google. And I would say, like, just knowing where you live out in the West Valley. Go look at the West Valley, get the Onyx map, and then just say, where is my state land trust? Where's my BLM, not that one,
Bureau
Bureau
of
of
Land
Land
Management.
Management. Oh, that word that has been hijacked. So look for your BLM land, and then look for your national forest and any dirt road out there. I would just drive it, and if you drive it in the morning, there's a good chance you're going to see quail. And so wherever you see quail, well, then get out and I would go see how big the covey is. Just don't get bit by a snake. But I do that in the off season a lot. I drive dirt roads. Sometimes I'm looking for spots to rabbit hunt later. Or I'll just, sometimes I just love driving out in the back country with my kids or, whatever. But and I started working with Randy Babb on doing quail counts of birds crossing the road. And there's what makes Arizona special to me is, boy, there's a lot of spots where you can go 10 miles, 12 miles, 15 miles on dirt road. And so those are some easy things to do. The dirt roads in the mornings or in the afternoons, evenings, but the mornings they seem to be a little more active. And then I would say, as well as like drainages, big washes, you'll usually find those birds.
Definitely.
Matt said it earlier though, like to me, I wouldn't waste your time on a bunch of these. It's called, I think they're called what they're that creosote, and there's like these
Yeah.
creosote flats all around the Phoenix Valley, and they're
That's a
basic.
racetrack for those birds. All they're going to do is run. The creosote does a really good job at not allowing a lot of vegetation to grow underneath them. And so it's great cover for quail. But it's a racetrack. A quail will run straight through there, and then you're going to be bobbing and weaving. Your dog's going to be bobbing and weaving. You won't catch up to them.
It's fruitless to hunt. It's
Driven.
basically.
If you drive a two track and you get some birds that hop out and they start running the two track, I've clocked them at 15 miles an hour and dust flying off of their little feet, and they'll just keep on running. I don't know about you, I don't really want to, nor can I really run 15 miles an hour. And so. The creosote or greasewood, sometimes it's called. It's a racetrack for them. Are birds there? Yes. I almost avoid that like Cholla because it's not productive.
It's not, and I think you've got to. So again, those dirt roads, looking at washes, but main thing is just making sure you're not, especially with you, with urban sprawl, and suburban communities developing everywhere around you.
you want to get on land that you can hunt without getting in trouble. And so get out there. And a lot of times there's great numbers of birds just right beyond the suburban push, because they might be artificially supported by water from the big communities or whatever. And so they've grown their numbers over the years. And that was really great habitat at one point in time. But there's a lot of great quail hunting all around the Phoenix Valley. And for me, it was just getting on the map, seeing where I could hunt, finding those dirt roads, and then just getting out. So, all right, well, let's go to another one of the questions. What do you got on here?
So, another question about off-season dog handling. So I got this dog about a month ago, right when the season ended, unfortunately. And he's, you know, just a little bit of background. He's an English pointer. I got him from the same place that Ryan got his dog, Happy. And he's an older dog, about 8 years old. But I've seen he's trained, and I work him every single day, 30 minutes to an hour. I'll take him out. And there's this big field, grass field behind my house, and there's birds there every single evening. There's dove and sometimes quail, and so I'll just have him, you know, we'll walk through that area and he'll point at them, and then just kind of walk through that area with him. What's some things that I can do, you know, off season, training this dog, getting him ready to just be out on a hunt? I've never hunted with him, so I don't know what he's going to do, but just kind of some things to look out for, maybe train him, or some tips for this off season.
Yeah, that's great. Matt's a guy with six dogs. You know, I've trained dogs, Labradors and pointers, but Matt would be great, because Matt's also not your super trial dog guy. So he's your great gun dog, and his dogs are high performing dogs. So I'm curious, Matt, what are your thoughts? How can he advance his dog at the age the dog's at? And I know of this dog is a very good dog. It's a great dog.
Sure. So one thing about you seeing the birds, that's one thing that kind of validates, you know, yeah, there's some birds for the dog. I would be, and this is just me personally, but I would be hesitant on having your dog sight point versus scent point. And so, you know, I've seen some dogs, like say clients' dogs, that, you know, they'll say, like, I take my dog for a walk every single morning, and we get into quail, and my dog sees the quail, and he points it, and it's great. And I'm thinking, that's actually, in my opinion, that's not that great. You don't want your dog to sight point. You want your dog to literally look with its nose, not its eyes. So I would be hesitant personally on putting your dog on too many birds with not a lot of cover, and so therefore the dog's just literally looking for birds with its eyes. I don't want my dogs to be looking for dogs looking for birds with their eyes. They should be exploring out there and just looking with their nose. So that would be one little piece of advice there. Other thing, seeing that we're approaching spring, if our winter will let go of us here, gambles will be, if not already, paired up. So you certainly don't want to pressure paired up birds, and soon we'll have a hen on a nest, and so you wouldn't want that hen to leave that nest and abandon it, because it's being pressured and realizes this predator keeps coming back, you know, if you get your dogs on there. So as much as you want to get your dog on some wild birds, we are approaching, if not at the time, to where it's not advisable and nor ethical to be getting your dog on those birds. Also, Game and Fish certainly frowns upon working your dog on wild birds outside of the season. It's considered harassing game. So I would definitely be hesitant on that. As much as you want the dog to learn and accelerate, here's the off season. This is where pen-raised birds kind of really come into play, to where you have access to, or you can have access to pigeons or bobwhite, you know, pen-raised quail. And then you can actually, you know, stash that bird in some grass and some cover, bring your dog around on a 20-foot, like, check cord leash, and then have that dog see that bird with its nose and not with its eyes.
Yeah, you know, we got a dog training buddy out there, Malacone.
Yeah.
Malacone. And I think I'm pronouncing that right. But
Correct.
He's a neat fella. So I think one of the things too is, Nate, is, I mean, that's, I was really great because I wouldn't have told you that. I didn't think like that because, you know, like I grew up in my mindset with the duck dogs. So, you know, like I'm not thinking about sight versus scent, you know, because duck dogs actually work off a lot of sight. You know, I mean, they have to. The birds are in the air. So, of course, they have to do scenting when the bird drops on the ground, on the water, or in the ground. But my labs, they would watch the birds in the sky, and I would look in the water at my dog's reflection to see where the birds were at. So their sight was crucial for the hunt. But Matt's absolutely right. I think that walking your dog right now in birdie area actually isn't very productive. Not near as much as what will be is for us, which I've got my game bird license now, and so we can go, and I've got the ability to buy chuckers, pheasant, and quail, and if you know, and so we can do some training, and then also pigeons. You know, like I'm trapping pigeons. We can go do that together, and then Guy Malicone out there in the West Valley does a lot of work out there, and we should do a podcast, and Guy will probably show you around. So, anything else you want to add? Any kind of water conditioning or anything you do, like just for fun with your dogs, Matt, during the summer?
It's not too common to get into a covey of quail and then and you say, "Oh, whoops, I just dropped that quail into water." I personally I don't do a lot of water retrievals with my dogs simply because it doesn't apply to them. Like would it help them? I guess it could diversify their skills. However, it's not necessarily a scenario that I get into, so I just don't focus on that. If anything, for me, water is just playtime for the dog. It's really good exercise and it's really good resistance, for their muscles and stuff. So that's the only really water exposure that I introduce my dogs to personally.
Same for me. It's with Zona. She's, if you look at her, she looks like a little bodybuilder, and I work her in water. Not a same thing. Not because I think a quail is going to be in the water, but I like to be on the water in the summer. It's hot, you know, and I want to take my dog, and so I want my dog to get strong and stay strong. So that's what I'm doing during the summer. All right, you got another question? A couple, and then we'll wrap up.
Probably be my last question is for opening weekend, I guess, for the season. And I know this is kind of a deer mentality. Like you touched a little bit about this on this earlier. You're saying, you know, for big game hunters, you got to hit that. If you're not hitting opening week or weekend, you kind of lose out on a missed opportunity. Is that as crucial when it comes to quail hunting? As far as getting out there, I believe it's in October, in the beginning of October. I know for us in Phoenix, it's still pretty warm in October, and so some hunters like to wait until it cools off a little bit. Or, you know, what's your thoughts on just getting out there in the beginning? And then second part of that is just kind of ideal timing of day, whether it's morning, afternoon, or evening. When do you think or find it's the best time to go? So two-part question there.
Sure. So, good question. We'll be opening somewhere middle of October this upcoming season, just as we did last season, the seasons prior. In my opinion, definitely still too hot to be running dogs. Number one, rattlesnake threat. Number two, overheating. So I personally don't run dogs here in the Southwest until the end of November. Just much cooler temperatures for everything that I just mentioned. As far as humidity levels for scenting conditions, the beginning of the day, that's when you're going to have your highest amount of humidity, unless we have a storm come through. So when you do feel that it's safe enough to run dogs in the season, mornings are very productive simply because humidity and scenting conditions are high. Typically in the Southwest, we have higher humidity in the morning. However, unless we have like a low pressure system coming through, then we don't really have a lot of air movement in the mornings. And so it's not a perfect world. If you could have 80% humidity and 10 mile an hour consistent winds, well, all you have to do is just drop dogs off the tailgate and walk into the wind, and you have a good enough dog, it'll find some birds. But as that ball of fire comes up over the mountains, that humidity literally just gets vaporized by the minutes. And so mornings are definitely very productive because birds are coming off their roost. and they're going to be active and they're going to want to get out and feed. Middle of the day tends to slow down a little bit. However, most upland birds, especially quail, they're kind of on the move, for most of the day. And you can still have some productive midday, but your humidity is going to plummet down, say between say 12, 2 o'clock is when you're going to have the least amount of humidity here in the Southwest. We've had several seasons to where it's been single percent humidity range, which is very, very difficult, even for a very well-seasoned dog that is used to the Southwest and low humidity conditions. And then as the day, it comes towards, the sunset, humidity starts to rise a little bit. We typically have a little more air movement, late morning, midday. But then I always have ethics in mind to where those birds need to covey up in the evening for many reasons. To stay warm overnight and really just to, so they have more eyes and ears on each other to keep each other safe in that covey so predators don't get to them. So I think it's pretty advisable. The way I run my personal hunts or guided hunts for desert birds, I don't hunt past 4 o'clock, but that's just me. And then also on Mearns quail, because they just don't covey up as quick as the two desert bird species do, I cut my hunts off personal and guided at 3 o'clock because they just don't covey up quick like the two desert bird species do. They're just not as vocal either as well, because their main defense mechanism is to sit down, hunker, shut up, and then wait until the predator's gone, and then they can call each other in. So that would be my advice on the time of day.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, would you say sunrise, like as early as you can see, or I
Oh
get
yeah.
okay.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if I would be I'd be driving some two tracks before the sun's up, and then make sure that it's, of course, no matter what state, you're in, every state's different, so you definitely have to pay attention to game and fish regulations on when you're actually allowed to hunt on daily, for first daylight kind of thing, or first light, 30 minutes before sunrise. But there's several states where you have to pay attention to where there are time frames that you cannot hunt. I think it's maybe South Dakota or something. You can't hunt till mid-morning or something. So one of the few Western states I have not hunted, but certainly be aware of game and fish regulations on when shooting times are legal.
Yeah, and I mean for me, I don't go really early in the morning. I will if I have a lot of energy and I'm really out the door early. A lot of times I'll leave the house like, as the sun is coming up or something like that, and then I'll drive an hour, to a location. And so for me, I like if I'm out there by 8, 9, 8 o'clock would be great. 9 o'clock would be like, 10 o'clock, I'm like, oh man, I feel like I'm behind,
Yes.
But it depends on what you're looking for. I mean, yeah, if you really want to see maximize the amount of birds you're gonna see, yeah, get out there by sunrise. I mean, like when Randy, when he asked me to do some quail counts, which we're driving dirt roads and I'm trying to get more volunteers. I mean, he wants us out there like basically like right at the beginning of sunrise. I mean, driving dirt roads and finding that out. So anyway. One of the things I wanted to just make mention of is early in the season, there's a higher possibility, a lot higher possibility and probability that you're going to encounter rattlesnakes. And that's one of those things like, if you get bit, you get bit, you're not going to die most likely, but it's probably going to forever change your leg. Like you're probably going to lose a lot of the muscle. You're probably gonna, I mean, it doesn't matter what all they do. I mean, these snakes are intense, and there's a lot of bad stories with snake bites. And so dogs too. Some dogs I think can probably have they can recover as well and maybe not die, but a lot of them can die from that.
Absolutely.
But they're going to be changed oftentimes, and it always depends on, is it a small snake and do they inject a ton of venom? And so gaiters or snake chaps, I would say, would be a good idea if you're going to get out early in the season. And then the other thing is to note that I wanted to make mention of, and I haven't shared it with anybody, but I was out hunting, I think it was January. The season was closing or getting closer to the end of the season, and I'm hunting, and it was 30 something for the low.
and then it hit like 50 for the day, and we encountered a major rattlesnake. And now he was docile, but from most quail hunters that I know, they could testify, if they've been hunting in Arizona, you could encounter a snake at any month of the year.
Yep.
So
yep.
Snakes are something like, for me, I see guys all over Facebook, Instagram, and they're all talking about how they went out and hammered them opening weekend and all that stuff. Like, to me, I'm just like, eh, I just don't like the idea of getting tangled up with a snake. That's kind of for me. I'm just anti snake encounter guy.
I tell people all the time that, you know, snakes are out 12 months a year. They're just not out 365 days of the year. Yeah. So there's, it's definitely common, you know, again, back to where I think we started this in the beginning of the podcast of, if you walk through the desert like you own it, eventually the desert will own you. So you certainly have to be very well aware of your surroundings. We have one of our girls who's 12 years old now, and she took a Western Diamondback strike to the chest when she was maybe a year and a half old. She's still alive today. She still has a scar on her chest with some like jelly like scar tissue underneath her skin, a little bit of hair still missing. Pretty scary, you know, 3 nights in ICU, 1 vial of antivenin, and she made it, but, some
like
dogs are not that lucky.
Later, $5,000 later,
inflation is horrible, but, back then I will say it was pretty close to $3,000 or so. Yeah. And I to save her and any of my other dogs, I'd do it all over again. I have insurance on my dog. So there's something that maybe, you might want to consider there, Nate, that there's a lot of insurance companies out there for dogs, and especially if you're going to have a working dog, it's not a bad idea. All my dogs are insured, and it's just a part of the game to where you can offset your costs, just like having car insurance that you hope you never have to use it, but when you do, you'll be glad that you have it. I had one of my other girls. She, I think it was two grouse seasons ago in September in northern Arizona, she ate some poisonous mushrooms, rushed her to the vet, and it almost took her life. She was knocking on death's door. It was pretty scary. So along the list of hazards that I now have on my list is mushrooms. So when you're up in the forest and stuff and hunting for grouse, be aware of what the scenery may be amazing, but you've got to pay attention to your dog and their behavior and wonder like, something's wrong with my dog. You know, they can't talk, verbally, but their body language says a lot. So there's, I advise a lot of people, if you really love your dog, you might want to insure your dog, and you'll probably thank me later.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the things most people don't think about, but if you that kind of insurance idea, and then just the threats that can happen with the dogs is those snakes and those mushrooms and a number of other things. But getting out there early in the season, I would say that you're going to have plenty of other times. Here's one little trick that I've used for getting out early in the season when I just feel like I got to go, for a couple things. One is I'll go early in the season, but I'm not running my dog in snakey country. So now there's plenty of other guys that will. I just won't, because I don't want to pay for it, and I don't want my dog to go through that, and I don't want to mess with that. The other thing I'll do, though, is I'll go out, and I'm like kind of like scouting, but I'm scouting with an opportunity to shoot a bird. You know what I mean? That's how I think about it. Like, I'm driving a dirt road that I know where there's birds at, and I'll stop, and I'll go to an area that I've already planned out. This is where I know there's birds, and I might get out, and I'm walking in not hyper snaky country, and I don't have my dog out, and I might scatter a covey and pop one, and then go pick it up and go walk back to the truck and go, okay, I know where they're at. I'll come back later when it cools down. The other thing I'll do when it's early in the season is I'm going to go as high as I possibly can go in elevation, because I know, and I'll watch temperatures. And I don't know what the rule is for you, Matt, but for me, it's been like, I need a frost. I want some frost. I want the ground to frost, because I think that triggers the snakes to go hibernate.
Yeah, numerous times. Yeah, just everyone has a weather app on their phone. Just wherever you plan on hunting, keep an eye on the weather. Lows are nice to see in the freezing temperatures, but then it's the Southwest. Our temperatures swing
Oh,
so
yeah.
widely to where you're going, oh, cool. It was 29 last night and a high of 72. What? Well, that's not good enough. I mean, like,
Yeah.
yeah, you may want to get, you could get out there for an hour, no more than two, and then you got to get out. You get out before it's too late.
Yep. And get out exactly. Get out of there if it's warming up, 'cause you can overheat those dogs too. And that's what I think guys do in the early season, is they run those dogs so hot. And it can be fatal for those dogs. So, anyway. Well, Matt, thanks for being on the program. Any closing comments, or Nate, any closing words?
No, I appreciate you taking the time to invite me along the podcast and looking forward to more episodes after this.
Yeah, man. Thank you. I mean, this is the first one down in the book. So, well, those of you that are listening, so glad you joined us. Stay tuned for more upcoming podcasts. We have Randy Babb, Arizona Game and Fish biologist, doing a lot of great work and has been a friend to Arizona Quail Today. Wade Zarlingo as well will be up. And then as well, Dan Priest, the founder of Q5 and founder of Arizona Quail Today. And I look forward to doing those. And Matt, it's always a great time connecting with you. I look forward to connecting with you more, perhaps in this off season. And we'd love to have you back on the show. So thanks for being a part.
Likewise, thank you.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Thanks for listening in. To help further our work, please consider making a tax-deductible gift. Visit us online at azquailtoday.com and be sure to follow us on social media for the latest information and updates. Till then, remember to get outside.